What I think we should speak about, I mean, the title that I've given this evening's discussion is, I'm not sure you're listening to this. The title that I gave this evening's discussion is Divine Action and Human Reaction. But I think that the particular branch of that subject that we should discuss is what happens when divine action causes certain political and social unrest to occur, then what is the human Jewish reaction? How should we understand that situation? I'm not speaking about any particular situation, although you won't believe me. But what I'd like to talk about is that subject in general, and I would like you to see it in two applications. One, I mean, apart from the idea in general, what the Jewish sources have to say about our response to the non-Jewish society and our place in it, and what happens when certain events or changes take place there, but also with regard to two particular areas in the world. One, again, we won't be specific about it, but one is a certain Middle Eastern country that happens to mean a lot to you and me, and the other, a certain Southern Hemisphere country. Not too far away. If we can keep the discussion on the level of Torah and not at the level of insensitivity that these things have been battered into. First of all, it's a difficult subject to grasp in general. Secondly, there is a lot of misconception that we have to work through in order to understand the subject. We've been brought up in a very specific way of thinking. We've been brought up very specifically with a very strong Western liberal bias, and from that's with regard to one of the two countries that I mentioned before, and with regard to the other one, a very strong Zionist bias. And that shapes our thinking, both for good and for bad, on these issues. And therefore, let's see if we can make a few general remarks, again, without being specific at all, that maybe can give us a little bit of direction. What is going to be, and what we'll have to, what strengths will be requested and required from us, I have no idea. No one knows the future. But the general principles that apply, we can define. If you think you're going to walk out of here knowing whether you should update your passport or plan a trip, no, that's not what we're here to discuss. But the theme that underlies all decisions that have to be made in these situations, that we certainly do have to understand. Let's maybe approach it this way. Try and give you a unique insight into an angle of this subject that we're perhaps not used to thinking about, and then let's see if we can try and work out its application in terms of the particular political areas or areas of responsibility that we mentioned, and perhaps in a broader context as well. The theme that springs to mind, the way I personally see it, and I can't guarantee that my personal view of how these facts should be put together is correct. I mean, I make no apologies, and I quite open about the fact that everything I say here is virtually a quote from my particular Rebbe, or at least my Rebbeim in general, and therefore you can stake your life on the things that you've heard here, generally speaking, except where I don't have the depth to be able to correctly represent those great sources. But apart from that, you can take it as Torah. Here, the theme, the general underlying idea, you certainly can, but what you will understand is my particular application of these ideas to particular situation, that you'll have to make your own decisions about. But I'm certainly not personally a person who is so imbued with Torah depth that everything I say is Torah and truth. The people I've been privileged to learn from certainly are on that level. So you need to filter this through your own consciousness and your own particular experience and wisdom. But the underlying ideas, I think, are like this. The thought that comes to my mind is a statement I once heard quoted in the name of Rav Henkin, who was a great rabbi of the previous generation in America. And he's reputed to have said the following idea. If you could just understand this idea, it's the most fantastic clarity for a Jew to be able to understand and apply to all political and social circumstances throughout history. And he said the following idea. I haven't seen it written in his name, and I haven't heard it quoted word for word, but I understand that the idea was as follows. He's reported to have said that there are two kinds of Jew. Two kinds of Jew as a response to two different kinds of period in Jewish history. The one he called the Tanakh Jew, and the one he called the Talmud Jew. The Tanakh, well, let's try and explain these ideas. The Tanakh Jew, he said, was a Jew who has to rule in a royal fashion, and the Talmud Jew is a person who has to walk between the raindrops. That's what he said. That is apparently, that's what he's reported to have said. Let's see if we can get under the skin of this statement and see what it means for us. Again, be warned that there'll be a lot of elements here that will go against the way traditional Jewish education here and elsewhere has been oriented. It's my personal belief that you can explain almost all of modern political and social aspiration and activity within the Jewish community on the basis of this idea, and point out clearly its mistakes and its effective, non-mistaken areas. The basic idea is as follows. The background idea, the basic idea is as follows. Who's taking this? Are you personal? The basic idea is as follows. See, I possess the only copy of this thing in a recording, and if you quote me afterwards, I'll deny it. But the basic issue is as follows. Tanakh Jew means that there is a phase of Jewish history that we refer to as the period of Tanakh. Tanakh, for those who don't know, is Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, meaning the canonical or biblical period. The period that spans the beginning of the Jewish people from the beginning of the writing of the Torah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or at least from Sinai, at least writing of the Torah, entry into the land of Israel, whenever you want to place the beginning of that period, until the closing of what in English is called the Bible. It's not the Bible, it's the Tanakh. The 24 books of the canon, or of the so-called written law, right? Ending with Divrei Yomim, with the prophets, judges, Samuel, kings, Tehillim, the Megillahs, and what they call in English chronicles. If you put those together with Chumash, you have 24 books of Tanakh, and those books represent a Jewish spirit when the Jewish spirit in the world and Jewish conduct is posited or postulated or predicated on a certain emotion. Then after that you have the period called the period of the Talmud, which I'm sure you're familiar with, meaning the period of the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the writing down of the Mishnah, the transmission of the Mishnah, the writing down of the Mishnah, the writing down of the Gemara, takes us down to the present day, and basically synonymous with exile. Living in Galut, in Golus. That exile phase is very different from the biblical phase, which is a non-exile phase. Of course, there was exile there too. There were 70 years outside the land of Israel between the first and second bais. There was certainly exile. Not all of it took place in the land of Israel. But the general theme of the non-exile phase, of the living in Israel phase, of the rulership of King David and King Solomon, King David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, the Jewish kings of Judea, that general period is characterized by a certain theme or ideology. The Talmud period, the exile period that we live in now, and the fact that Israel exists at a state now doesn't affect the Torah concept of exile. It does certainly affect our existence in many ways. Try and make that clear. But we're still in the non-messianic exile phase. Exile, you should know, Golus doesn't mean geographically whether you're living inside the borders of Israel or outside it. During the whole of the period of exile, there have been Jews living in the land of Israel, but we certainly haven't regarded it as redemption. I hope everyone's with me on that. The fact that a lot of Jews happen to live in Israel right now has got absolutely nothing to do with redemption. Let's not say absolutely nothing to do with the redemption. There's an opinion in the Torah world that it's the beginning of the redemption, but it's not the final redemption, that's for sure. Everybody agrees on that. I want to get into the heavy enough political issues here without having to introduce more. What's the difference between these two phases? And how are they characterized, and what do they mean to us? Let's see if we can try and understand this idea. The idea of the so-called Tanakh phase, or let's call it the non-exile phase, or living under the rulership of King David, King Solomon, is a rule or a system where Jewish consciousness is leadership-oriented. It means that we run things, not just in our own sphere, we run the cosmic system, literally. But even if you want to look only in the political sphere, we certainly ran the world. When King David ruled. So what happened was the world was run according to Torah. It wasn't just that in that little corner of the Middle East. So there was a sort of a Jewish reality. But the rest of the world subscribed, right? He was such a messianic figure. He was such a great figure that people came from all over. And the way the Jewish people conducted themselves was royal. There was a conduct of royalty that the rest of the world acknowledged, the rest of the world was forced to acknowledge. That was the political dispensation, that was the reality. Torah ruled the world. The laws of the Torah ruled the world. David HaMelech had authority to wage war. He had authority to take over certain neighboring countries when he saw fit. I mean, there was a rulership in which was vested the power of life and death that ruled not only the Jewish people locally, but ruled the world. In the days of King Solomon, it was even more emphasized. When Shlomo HaMelech ruled, when King Solomon ruled, beginning at age 12, when he came to the throne and he made his first wise decision. For 40 years, it says, the country was ruled in that way without any war. The peace, the harmony, the Torah rule was so perfect, David prepared it. But when his son, Shlomo, brought in that age of rule, when the Beis HaMikdash was built, I mean, for the time when we lived in Yerushalayim, all Jews lived in Israel, the temple stood, miracles were constant, there were 10 constant miracles that you saw in the Beis HaMikdash, 10 constant miracles, prophecy was around, prophecy was alive and well, there were prophets, the world was incandescent with Jewishness, with Yiddishkeit, Torah was palpable, the whole world was ruled, people came, fabulous kings and queens came to visit from the far reaches of the earth, just to hear a few words from his mouth. He had such an unbelievable wisdom and such a control over the world, it says he sent animals to the bottom of the sea to fetch him exactly certain things that he knew where they were. Then the whole physical, whole cosmic structure was run according to his wisdom. And many, many tales of kings and queens and people who had traveled across the globe in those days to hear just a few words of wisdom spoken from a man of prophetic and royal level and insight. There were other generations like that. It says in the days of King Chizkiah, for example, in case you think that was the only time. In the days of King Chizkiah, it says that the Jewish people lived according to Torah, and they didn't have to wage war, because the power of their Torah learning was so strong that it preserved them. They didn't even need any. It says that King Chizkiah put a sword across the top of the Beis Medrash door, the yeshiva door, the people were sitting and learning, put a sword, he hung a sword up, and he said, anybody who stops learning, be pierced with this. In other words, you learn Torah in this generation on pain of death. And there are commentaries who say, where does it say anywhere in Jewish law that if a person doesn't learn Torah, he deserves death? You can't just make up a law like that. Moshim say that the idea behind that law was that the life and death survival of that generation was on their Torah learning, not on their military prowess. The fact that they were able to learn Torah to that level of intensity was the merit that kept them preserved. And that's why if somebody broke away from that tradition, he wasn't being punished for not learning Torah, he was being punished for endangering the Jewish people. Because of desisting from learning of Torah at that incredible level of intensity made us that bit closer to a normal human nation. And not a transcendent people living in the transcendent wisdom of Torah. And that was why you're allowed to kill somebody for doing that, because of threat to your life. But it says in that generation the people of Israel learned Torah to such intensity that it says, Midan va'ad Beersheba, from the town of Dan to Beersheba, the whole length and breadth, the whole north-south extent of Eretz Israel, you couldn't find, it says, Tinoik or Tinoikas, you couldn't find a baby. A baby, it means a child, old enough to speak, who didn't know all the laws of Tum and Tyre. You hear that? That means you could stop a child on the street, old enough to speak, and never mind, and he would be able to tell you all the laws, ask him anything in Torah, a child would be able to tell you. Today, stop a Jew in the street, never heard of Tum and Tyre. Heard of Tum. The point is that that's what that generation was. It was a generation that lived on Torah, it was royal, that was the conduct in the world, that's what ruled the world, ruled the Jewish people, and that's what ruled the world. We didn't take instructions from anyone. Listen carefully to each detail because you'll see how it affects our consciousness. The Jewish people didn't take instructions from anyone. No one told us what to do. There was no financial support that was needed from elsewhere. There was no bargaining that had to be done in terms of somebody else's values sort of compromising and so on. Nothing like that. What we said went. What the Jewish king said went across the world. There's much more to say about it, but that's the general picture. However, the picture of exile, the picture of Golos is exactly the opposite. The picture of the exile is the picture of a Jew who's obsequious and bent over and doesn't dare reply. What he said, walking between the raindrops, never disagreeing. Always having to compromise. And of course that was a necessity. It wasn't just, we have to understand where this idea comes from in Torah depth, but that was the practical reality. During the time of exile, there wasn't any possibility, never mind not having an army. There wasn't even a refuge. A Jew didn't even have it. It was only by the grace of some non-Jewish country that a Jew was allowed to live there. There are many generations in Jewish history when Jews said that if I walk in the street and a goy doesn't kill me just because he's tired. That's what was said in Eastern Europe in the last generation. And it wasn't a joke or an exaggeration, by no means. So there were, and that's the majority, Jewish history since the destruction, the whole of the exile of this phase has been that kind of history. We, those of us who grew up after the beginning of the State of Israel, it's very hard for us to picture that. But we always sort of think we can go there at least. Or that there is, you know, if you get stuck any place in a very unpleasant situation, they'll send a few commandos, you see, to help us. That's how we've sort of grown up, always with that insurance, with that assurance. But you must imagine what it was like before that date. When there wasn't even a place to run to, there was no place you could go. Even if you could get out of where you were, it was probably worse where you were hoping to get to. Never mind not having a place to go where your life was safe. Wherever you were, you weren't even regarded as a citizen. You weren't allowed to engage. Never mind making a living. The most of the ways of making a living, you weren't allowed to engage in. And so forth and so on. I'm not going to revise Jewish history for you. This at least what one should be familiar with. So that was a phase of Jewish history where by necessity the Jew was always in a position of being second class, and he had to behave that way, but his life depended on it. Very different picture from the picture of Tanakh times, when there would be a life and death authority that a Jew, that was vested in a Jew, in any Jew, by virtue of the fact that he came from the nation that was the ruling authority of the known world. That's the scene, that's the picture. Now let's try and understand the depth of this idea, its sources, and let's try and understand our obligation in terms of this idea. You'll begin to feel, I think, that the problem here is that the second phase of this so-called Talmud or exile phase of the Jew who always is second class, second rate, who must compromise, who's not ruling, who does not have a militant stand, who cannot afford to have a militant position, that's the phase that applies now since the beginning of the State of Israel too, and that's where the confusion arises. Because we've been brought up with the consciousness of the Tanakh Jew in a world that really applies to the Talmud Jew. And if you think about that idea carefully, you'll see it explains many, many, many problems in philosophical outlook that we have in this generation. But let me try and make it clear. The origin of this idea, the origin of this is as follows. Where is it that the beginning of the idea of the Jew having to bow down to the non-Jew and accept his rulership and his authority, even in areas where Jewish consciousness was more developed and where we knew more and better, where does that come from? Not just accidental meanderings of history. These are rooted in the cosmic structure of the world. So here the Mephoshim say the following idea. The root of this happened at the beginning of Jewish history. They hear well every detail. Again, I'm avoiding saying a lot of things that certainly would be taken wrongly if they were made specific. So I'm leaving it to you to hear the, to make the applications. At the beginning of Jewish history, when it says that the beginning of the tension between Jew and non-Jew, as I'm sure you're aware, was between Jacob and Esau. Yaakov and Esau, yes, it says that between them was built this rivalry that this generation experiences now, because Esau was the forerunner of the Esau-Edom peoples. The Roman Empire, the Greek and Roman legacy and empire in the world, leading to the Western bloc of nations that hold power in the world now, excluding the Eastern nations for the moment. That Western bloc of nations is known as the Edom bloc. That's a direct descendant of Esav in terms of his descendancy in the world and his philosophy in the world. And we have a thing quite clear. It says, Halacha, Esav, so is Yaakov. It's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. That the non-Jew hates the Jew. It's not accidental. It's therefore our benefit. You have to talk about anti-Semitism another time, although you'll see it comes into this very deeply. Is that when we behave as very, very deeply observant Jews, then we're not disliked by the non-Jew. We're very intensely respected. But when we try to become like him, then he reminds us that we're not like him. That's the push and pull of the divine energy of anti-Semitism in the world. That's what it says Kabbalistically, and that's what it says in all sources. That when we live according to the way we should live, they have the highest respect for us. Don't dislike us at all. We're not a threat to them at all. Totally different wavelength. We're doing what we should be doing spiritually, and they're running the world, which is what they want. And that's what they're supposed to be doing. That's what they're supposed to be doing beautifully. Are we together? But when we try to run the world that they're supposed to be running, then we start intruding on their area. And in order to help us remember what we're supposed to be, a spiritual people, they're not a physical people, then they get very upset about it and they start torturing and butchering us to remind us that we're intruding in something we shouldn't be. That's the underlying theme of the historical pathway of anti-Semitism in the world. Check it out, examine it, go through the various generations and you'll see. That process began when Yaakov and Esav chose different worlds. They were destined to have different worlds. Esav was destined to make this world beautiful for a spiritual reason in its perfection, and Yaakov was destined to take the beautified physical world and connect it to the spiritual source, and together they were supposed to make a marriage. They were in fact twins, after all. They were twins who were supposed to harmoniously build both aspects of the world. Esav was supposed to take the world in its physical aspect, make it beautiful and develop it, and Yaakov was supposed to stay out of that and learn Torah and make the spiritual connection of a beautified world with a spiritual source, and both would reap the benefits of each other. Of course, what happened was Esav, the non-Jewish nations, got stuck into the physical world for its own sake and not for the spiritual purpose, and they gave up what they should be doing. Before you get carried away with it, you should realize that we're not exactly doing what we're supposed to be doing either, in case you think there's any criticism to be leveled over here, that the non-Jews are involved in physicality for its own sake. Not exactly possible to say at the moment that we as a nation in general are involved only in spirituality, for example. But that's not the point. The point is that they had two different roles. But they developed an enmity between them because in the beginning Esav stopped doing what he was supposed to be doing. He started getting sunk in to the physical world for its own sake. When Yaakov saw that, he realized that there was no way that he could rely on his brother to build physicality so that he could make the connection to spirituality. And he decided, actually it was his mother's insight, great, incredible, prophetic woman, Rivka, who saw that if Esav would be left to his own devices, the physical world would crash, and therefore she advised and taught Yaakov that he had to take over that role. And of course that's why he bought from Esav his task in the world. He bought from him his birthright, didn't cheat him out of it, he bought it from him. Esav didn't want it. He bought the birthright and the brachas. He bought everything that Esav needed. Why did Yaakov buy? Why did Yaakov need Esav's blessings? Why did he need it? Why did he need his birthright and his blessings? Because the birthright, the bechira, and the blessings were tools that were needed to build the world, and he wasn't building the world. So Yaakov had to take both on himself. In fact, the mystics say that's why he married both wives. You know that? The two brothers were supposed to marry two sisters. Yaakov was supposed to marry Rachel, and Esav was supposed to marry Leah. She was the ideal woman. She had such power, Leah. She was much higher mystically than Rachel was. She could match up to a man like Esav, and together they could perfect the world, the physical world. But when they saw that Esav wasn't doing what he had to be doing, so he couldn't use the partner that he needed to do their job, so Yaakov had to abrogate all the tools, you follow, that Esav had. And of course that left a tremendous bitterness in Esav when he saw that he had failed to live up to what was expected from him, and he wasn't doing the job that was demanded, and that Yaakov had to take from him the wife who was destined for him, the Bechira, the Brachas. That's what happened. And that left between them one of the ideas behind what left between them a tremendous lethal enmity. Now, what happened with this enmity? What happened? So we know that they had to separate. They had to separate for a long time. And when they saw each other again, Yaakov was afraid that Esav would kill him. You remember the story? It says that he spent the night alone, wrestled with an angel, preparing himself for the next day when he'd meet his brother. He was certain his brother would try and kill him. It says that he tried to prevent it. He tried, first he sent gifts to try and appease him. each detail that he did, we have to understand, because the Gemara brings down that that's the halachas of how a Jew should relate to a non-Jew. First he sent him gifts, and then he bowed down to him 7 times, and he said certain things to appease him, and then he prepared for war. If there'd be no way out, he'd have to be a fighter. That's what a Jew has to know, but that's the last resort. Not like this generation thinks that the first thing is you become militant. That's the last resort. Of course, you have to use that, you have to use it. And you have to do it well. That's what he did. And finally, it says that when Esav met him the next day, what happened was, he made all these preparations, and finally, when Esav came to meet him, he bowed down and he bowed and scraped and he called him, Sir, Adoni, my master. And he behaved in the most diplomatic way imaginable. And even then it says Esav tried to kill him. There's one opinion that when he fell on his neck to kiss him, he tried to bite him to death. There's one opinion that he really tried to kiss him as a brother because he was so moved by the separation. Which means that in the end, when we come back to closeness with our brothers, who are the descendants of Esav, after all, we both descended from Avraham Avinu. So there's one opinion that the kiss that he tried to give him was a kiss of love. And there's another opinion that he tried to kill him. And his teeth fell out, or Yaakov's neck turned to marble, or whatever the Midrash says, he wasn't able to. And that was one of the miracles that made Esav see that this man, that he wasn't going to manage to kill him. And that's why he desisted from trying to kill him, because he saw. The Midrash says many fascinating things, how Yaakov managed spiritually to overcome his brother in order to convince Esav. It says that while Esav was coming to meet him, he sent him wave after wave of gifts. And he stacked the gifts and separated them and timed them in such a way that they had the maximum effect. It says that he sent angels. There were divine emanations that greeted Esav. It says Esav was galloping towards Yaakov with 400 men with a bloodthirsty intent to kill him. First of all, it says that Yaakov made a mistake, that he disturbed Esav in the first place. He should have snuck by without being seen. But he sent a message to his brother, maybe we can make peace. And that was his first mistake. The Gemara says that in the dog sleeping, you don't wake him, because when you wake him and you find that he's about to bite you and you're holding his ears, you can't let go and you're stuck with him. He should have not awakened his brother's lethal anger, but he did. And as Esav came towards him to kill him, you don't understand what's going on here. It's not just two brothers back in history. We're talking here about the Jewish people and the non-Jewish nations of the world. That's what we're talking about, the cosmic source of this. So Yaakov sent out certain divine emanations that if you're interested, you can read the Midrash. And it says that as Esav was coming towards him, he saw a massive army come to meet him. They were really these angelic emanations in the form. And then, I think it says in Midrash, Sefer Yosha says that they pounded him to a pulp. They beat him with an inch of his life, these armed forces. And when Esav saw him with his last gasp, almost asked who they were, they said that they were humble servants of Yaakov. And then it happened again, you know, to cool him down a little bit. That there were these forces that were on the side of his brother. Many other things happened. And finally, by the time he was ready to meet Yaakov, so then, and even then according to one opinion, he tried to kill him, but at least according to one opinion, he didn't. And Yaakov was saved. Now, if you hear well, from this meeting, from this parasha in the Torah, of Yaakov meeting Esav, are learnt out the laws of how a Jew relates to a non-Jew in this space. In the non-Tanakh phase. That was not where the Jewish people were ruling the world as royal rulers of the world. That was the phase when we were a band of travelers, a non-militant, non-military band of travelers. It's a family. Esav was a mighty army. He had 400 men. The Maral says it doesn't mean 400. It means a complete expanse. Four is always all four directions of the earth. And times 100 always means raised to its maximum power. If you really want to know what it looked like nuclear arms. It looked like all the tanks in the world, all the nuclear, what it would look like in modern terms. And that's what it will look like, unfortunately, according to many, unless we unstick ourselves and do what we're supposed to be doing. Otherwise, we might have to face that. But the way we meet that is the way Yaakov met it. Now, there are commentaries who say that the reason we have to bow and scrape in this phase of Jewish history is because Yaakov did. There are those who say that he didn't have to do that. That if he would have met him royally, that means if he would have conducted himself in a Tanakh way, again, we're not on level to criticize Yaakov of him. But the point is, after all, he was a man who was able to stand up to an angel and beat him. An angel is of unlimited power. And there are those who say that because when Esav came to greet Yaakov. Yaakov chose to bow down to his brother. Had he met him with militancy, had he met him with a royal bearing, and refused to bow down, so for the rest of history we never would have had to do that. He had that power. And had he done it, we would never have to do it. But because our forefather put into the blood and genes of the Jewish people that way of conduct, so since we're born from him, we can't function any differently. Are we together? Because we can only be as a people what Yaakov was as a man. Since we're his spiritual descendants, not just a question of being genetically descended from him or physically, but since we are spiritually descended from him, we can only run the world, we can only relate to the world the way he did. Since he bowed 7 times and called him sir, it's the only way we can be successful in a generation where we have to come up against him. And therefore it says that whenever Jewish leaders of the Talmudic period had to meet non-Jews, they first studied this parsha. The Gemara says there was one great sage of that generation who had to go meet the Romans. He had to go to Rome. And he didn't go over this. They used to revise it intensely before they went to meet the Romans, because the Romans, obviously even more intensely than now, were the descendants of the Aesop people. So every time a Jew had to go to Rome, which was, can you imagine what hung on that decision? The Jewish people completely at the mercy of the Romans. And he had to go and represent the Jewish people to the Romans. He studied this parsha to know how to relate to them. How had Yaakov related to Esau? Because that's the only way we could survive. And the Gemara says on one occasion he didn't go over it and he made a mistake. What mistake? The Gemara says that after Yaakov and Esau met and Esau didn't kill him and he didn't have to fight and they made peace, they put their arms around each other. So then Esau said to Yaakov, let me provide you an escort. I'll escort you after we're brothers, we've made peace between each other. So let me escort you back to where you're going. I'll provide you armed soldiers, I'll look after you. Bodyguards. Yaakov knew that Esau's bodyguards were more of a threat than the people they were supposed to be protecting him from. He knew that. Yet the last thing he needed was Esau hanging around. The last thing he needed was Esau's cronies, henchmen. Yet to guard him, he knew that he'd be at more risk from them than he would from the people they were supposed to protect him from. I'll never forget, I once had a fantastic illustration of this. I once had to go to a... I don't want to mention names either. I once had to go to a youth camp, a seaside camp. You understand what I mean? A Jewish youth movement camp. And over there, the powers that be decided that they would hire bodyguards to protect the Jewish children at that camp, in case there would be any anti-Semitic, events or somebody would present any danger. The camp was in a forlorn part of the beach. Some place that nobody ever heard of. But in case anybody would be there, that would be a danger, they sent a small team of Angolan mercenaries that they hired. Okay? Each with a personal cache of weapons. So what happened on the train down, a hole was shot through somebody's suitcase. Fortunately, it didn't hit anybody, just the poor child had to wear clothes with holes in the front all the way through. A few people came very close to being shot to pieces over there. To say nothing of what happened to some of the girls. There was much more risk, I can assure you. There's much more danger presented by the bodyguards than there was from... When that happened to Yaakov, he told Esau, of course you don't say that to Esau. You don't tell him you don't need his bodyguards. You have to know how to speak to him. So Yaakov said to Esau, he said to him, listen, you have to know how to be diplomatic and you have to understand every word. He said to him, look, I walk slowly. I got children, all sheep and children. The regular yelodim, according to the foot of the children. That means the pace that the children walk at, that's how I go. By the way, that's a Jewish idea. Isn't that beautiful? He said to his brother, you're a military man. You sweep through the world on horseback. I walk at the pace of my children. Beautiful thing. But because of that, in other words, he was able to teach us that and speak to Esau in a way that he could understand. He said to him, he knew he was forming Torah in the world. He said to Esau, you ride ahead on horseback and I'll catch up to you. Don't worry about me. Who would want me? Who would attack me? So what have I got? I'll walk at the pace of my little ones. And until it says we come to Mount Seir. Mount Seir is the inheritance of Esau. One day I'll get there, finally, slowly I'll get there, and then we'll meet again. And the Mephoshim say, he really meant it. In the days of the Mashiach, it says, V'alim Moshim V'har Esav, L'Bahar Edem Lishpat. That means, V'har Seir, in the days of the Mashiach, then judges will go up on the Mount of Esav in his place, and he'll be judged. And it said, then he'll give back the gifts that he had, certain aspects of Torah, certain aspects of Jewish values that the non-Jewish world has, that they have that they shouldn't have. They'll give them back in the end of days, those gifts that Yaakov gave. And Esav was happy with that answer. He didn't hang around at the pace of children. No. So he left. And it says that this rabbi, this great sage during the Roman era, he didn't study this parsha. He studied this parsha. So when he went to Rome, and after he dealt successfully with the Romans said, allow us to provide an escort. We'll send a legion of Roman soldiers with you, and they'll look after you on the way home. And he forgot the way to handle it. So he gratefully accepted. Yes, and then he got into a lot of trouble. Whoever would have attacked him on the way would have been much better than the Roman bodyguards that they sent with him. But he made that mistake because he didn't go over this parsha. What the Chazal are telling you, what the Gemara is teaching, is that when you have to relate to the threat of the non-Jewish world, especially at its militant, aggressive, anti-Semitic worst, so then this is the way you have to, this is the parsha that you have to study. What does it teach us? What do we learn from this? What do we learn from this? What is this walking between the raindrops? What is the idea? Listen well. First, let me start the other way around, because I know that there are some sensitivities that find themselves unable to listen to this because of a lifetime of trying to think differently. Let me start the other way around. This will make you happier. That when the final stage comes, and when Yaakov catches up to Esav on his own turf, and when the Mashiach rules the world again, so then we'll be able to function in that way. Then we won't have to function. It'll be forbidden to function in this way, to call anybody sir and bow and scrape. Torah will rule the world. You should understand, even then, it's got nothing to do with revenge and vengeance. We never relate that way. You look in every single time that we ask for vengeance, we ask for the vengeance for Jewish blood to be avenged. We never, listen carefully, beautiful thing to know of Jewish people, on enemies that have done far worse than could have been expected from any normal humanity. Far more brutal and cruel than even describable. Even then, we don't ask for, when we talk about vengeance, that Jewish blood should be avenged, we always say that it should be avenged, or that Hashem himself should take vengeance in front of our eyes, that we should see that justice is done, but we never ask for the pleasure of it ourselves. You know that? We never say, look in all the tefillahs when we ask. For example, when we mention the name of a martyr who was killed 50 years ago, let's say, there's a tradition to say Hashem Yikoyim Damo. After his name, you put those letters, or you say that may Hashem avenge his blood. That's what we say. But we never ask Hashem to give us. You follow? We never ask that Hashem should give us the opportunity that we should have the pleasure of carrying it out. We're not interested in that. What could be more? Who could enjoy such a thing? You follow? Justice we want to see done. There's no question about it. The blood is crying out from the ground. It has to be avenged. But we never ask. We have no share in the pleasure of that. Nevertheless, what will happen will be that there will be a situation where the world will be run on messianic lines. The Mashiach will rule the world. He'll be the king of the world, literally. And everything will be run according to Torah. There'll be peace and harmony. Doesn't mean we'll become aggressors. On the contrary, it says all weapons will be smelted down and molded into tools of peace. And that'll be our pleasure. That'll be our pleasure. But then there'll be no bowing and scraping, no calling anybody sir, except the other way around. And it'll be the pleasure of the world to do what's needed for the spiritual reality that will rule the world. But in that phase, not in this phase. In that phase, when the world's run according to the correct Torah lines, then the Tanakh phase will be re-established. The royal line of David, David HaMelech, will be re-established, and the world will run that way, and no one will be able to put a foot out of line. And that conduct, that's what will rule the world then. But until that phase, it says, Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rosha, can never forget that possible. Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rosha, the world is given into the hand of the evil. The world is given into the hand of evil-minded individuals, that's who run the world. I mean, in case you need any proof of it, I mean, you think you have to sort of examine that proposition. Not only given over, but these days are given over voluntarily. I mean, if people voluntarily get together and vote into power, people who quite explicitly tell them that all they want is the power. The Jewish idea of leadership is to take the last person on earth who wants to be a ruler and force him into ruling. That's the Jewish idea of leadership. You take a man who's so humble, that the last thing in the world he wants is power over anybody, and you squeeze him into leadership. Doesn't that make sense? The last person you want having power over you is somebody who wants power over you. That's suicide. But the nations of the world actually want that, actually accept that. But it just, even in our own terms, it doesn't begin to make sense. The Jewish people, the first leader they ever had was Avraham Avinu. You know what happened? Hashem came to Avraham and said, you're the leader of the Jewish people. So he argued for 7 days why he really wasn't the right leader. He's arguing with the master of the world, why really he doesn't have what it takes. 7 days he argued, and Hashem said, look, who knows better, you or me? Well, Hashem, you do know better, but I'm not the man for the job. Find somebody else. I can't do it. Hashem, that's the man I want. That's the man I want. That's exactly that's the individual who I want. He said, yeah, I know that, Hashem, but despite that, I'm not the right man. Find somebody else. Until Hashem got angry. Until Hashem got angry with him. That's a Jewish leader. A Jewish leader is a man of complete self-control, a person of absolute humility, who doesn't feel at all capable of ruling anybody, has mastered his personality completely, and you take him and you force him into leadership. Can you imagine if the world were run by such individuals? Can you imagine? Again, with that, you won't mention any names. You look at certain countries. Let's say, for argument's sake, in the Northern Hemisphere. The individuals that come to power, individuals who've blustered and bullied their way to wealth or power over people, and they come to power by sort of brutally convincing others that they should be the one for the job, and they do it by showing, well, other man's no good. That's how they do it. That's not how the world will be run. That's not how the era of Mashiach will be run. But the thing to know is that until that phase, the world's given into this phase. And the way it's given over now is that it runs this way. And the way that it runs now is that the only way we can relate to it is like Yaakov related to us. And that's bowing and scraping and walking between the raindrops and saying, yes, sir, and sending gifts. And that offends the sensitivities and the sensibilities of the Western liberal idea and of the modern Israeli brought up culture, and all those spawned from that reality don't think that way. We have been taught to be Tanakh Jews in the era of Talmud Jews. That's what we taught. We were brought up on the images of young bronzed Israeli soldiers, right, who take matters into their own hands, and no matter how many, no matter what's arrayed against us, not the spiritual greatness that will do it, it's our might that will do it. Not only is that a wrong philosophy, that we're supposed to understand that it's only spiritual greatness that rules us, that is who we are, but it just won't work in this space. So let's try and understand this a bit more deeply. What's the wisdom behind it? What's the idea behind it? The idea behind it is this: no matter how strong you are, no matter what kind of an army you have, or how strong you've trained yourself, you know, in personal combat or whatever it is, the idea is Eretz Mitzvah V'Yad Rosha. You dare not argue. You may not argue with the Rosha. Only in some unique cases in Jewish history, the Jewish people in the Talmud phase, in this phase of not ruling, in the exile phase, were given permission to stand up militarily. Very, very seldom. Very seldom. In the days of Esther, the Purim time, when the whole Jews were threatened with being wiped out, even then they didn't prepare for battle. Even then, every Jew on earth was threatened with extinction. What happened 50 years ago was nothing compared to that. Nothing compared to what was planned. All Jews on earth lived in 127 countries of Ahasuerus, and there was a decree issued to kill them all on one day. And you know that battle's got nothing to do with it. If Hashem's against you, if he sends enemies against you because you're going to win by power, by fighting, by battle. The only exception was it happened at Hanukkah time. At Hanukkah time, which is really in the time of exile, with no prophets around anymore at all, and the Greek armies, the Syrian Greek armies, came against the Jewish people, so a handful of Yeshiva Bochrim, who the Kohanim were, never held a weapon before, they went out to fight. They went out to fight. Went out to battle. At Purim time, it says that the only one who was able to stand up to them, to the Persians, was Mordechai. He stood up to Haman. Instead of bowing and scraping, he did the opposite. And the Jewish people said, you're wrong. The Jewish people said, this is not the right phase. You have to bow down to him, bow down to him, and our lives depend on it. And Mordechai was able not to do that. And I told him, of course, he explained, he was a tzaddik gomor, he was an unusual class of person who's got absolutely no flaw at all. He came from Binyamin. You know why he was able not to bow down to Haman? Because he was a descendant of Benjamin, of Binyamin. You know what that means? That when Yaakov bowed down to Esav, all the tribes bowed down with him. You remember what happened? Yaakov lined up his wives, Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah. He lined them up with all the children. He lined up them in such a way, and Yosef and Rachel tried to put And they all bowed down in the end to Esav. But Binyamin wasn't born. Binyamin wasn't born yet. In fact, Haman sent a message to Mordechai and he said to him, why don't you bow down to me? My great-great-grandfather. Your great-great-grandfather bowed down to mine. I'm not asking you for more than that. Haman knew Jewish history. He knew how the Jews were supposed to relate in this generation. He sent a message to Mordechai. Don't make things difficult. You want to be wiped out. All you have to do when I walk past, show me a little respect. That's all. Your whole nation's doing it. And the precedent for it's in the Torah. When Esav came to meet Yaakov, well, Yaakov didn't behave like you. He bowed down to him. He called him sir. That's all I'm asking. A little respect. So Mordechai sent back a message. You know what? When Yaakov bowed down to Esav, Binyamin wasn't born yet. The last of the tribes running. He never bowed down. I'm descended from him. So my great-great-grandfather never bowed down to you, so I don't have to either. And he drove him crazy. And he drove him to destruction. But you have to be a rare exception like that. You have to know when. These guys started to know in which generation and how and what your merits have to be. But a very risky path. He was the only man in the Jewish people who thought so. And he had to do that. And at the time of Hanukkah, they took on a battle, which was a spiritual battle. I mean, they went out with swords and spears and they fought for 13 years and they wiped out, they destroyed, they defeated the Syrian Greek armies, the empire of the world at the time. But only because Hashem was behind them. And there's a whole explanation we have to go into maybe some other time, maybe Hanukkah time, on what it means and why they went to war. But the conduct of that generation, what it has to be the conduct of non-militancy. Let's see if we can understand a little bit deeper the wisdom behind this. It's not easy for young Jews to have to think this way. I hope you're beginning to see the conflict. Compounding the problem is the fact that not only have we been taught to stand up for our dignity and our rights and not be told what to do, yes, and show that we're prepared to fight, and we adulate and idolize those in the ghettos who fought, not those who retain Jewish values. Nothing wrong with those who fought, and there's nothing wrong with fighting, and they had to fight at the end. But to make whole museums and whole kibbutzim and all sorts of idolization and worship of people who fought at the end, that's not the Jewish pride. That's not Jewish pride. It's a Jewish pride also. But a very great Jewish pride is those people who had a crust of bread thrown to them when starving to death to make them scramble like animals, and they didn't scramble like animals. They fought to give it to each other. That's a Jewish victory. There's a much greater, much, much, much greater Jewish victory than fighting to the death at the end. Nothing wrong with fighting to the death at the end. It's a great Jewish victory also. Don't misunderstand. But when Jews were dehumanized, especially to make them look like animals, to show that the philosophy of the law of the jungle is the correct law, and Jews had some Torah depth in them, fought to show that they were human under those naked and brutalized circumstances, that's called the Jewish victory. But not only have we been complicated by that outlook, we've also been complicated by the fact that in the Western liberal system, we've been taught that you must stand up and speak out against the system. Also, you must stand up for what's right. You must be vocal and high profile. You must stand up in a society. Again, I'm not being specific. But you must stand up in a society and start telling them how to run things according to what's right and what's wrong. The fact that you happen to be a guest, that you happen to be tolerated when you didn't have to be, that's irrelevant. The fact that there may be risk involved in your own community is also irrelevant. Be very cautious here. Sometimes you do have to stand up and be counted, even when there's a risk. Even in a non-Jewish society. Sometimes yes, sometimes not, but you have to know. It's not a blanket rule. Das Torah has to decide exactly where and why. Let's try and study this phenomenon for a few minutes. The first element you have to know is that the underlying, what defines which elements of these kinds of behavior we use in which phase, right, is pragmatics and practicality, what works. Again, Jews often, non-Torah Jews, Jews brought up without Torah ideals, often have the idea that what looks good on the outside is what you have to do. You see, you stand up and make a statement and be seen. In a high profile way, you make a statement and you be seen to be standing up for what's right. Protest! That's not the Jewish idea. The Jewish idea is what works, not what seemed to look good. Are we together? The Jewish approach has always been, and I'll try and give you one or two examples that are not so closely related to us politically, it's a little bit easier to see. Painful examples. Let me give you one or two. Again, if you have to be obsequious and send gifts, and bribes even, and call somebody sir, is that a problem if you're going to save Jewish lives? What's the problem? But there are many in this generation who don't think so. There are many who are trying to think it, no matter what the cost is. There was a time at the destruction of the temple, during the days of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, there were people called the Baryonim. They were a militant young, militant Jewish faction in the town of in Yerushalayim at the time. I don't know if you know the story. The Gemara says quite clearly, quite openly, that the siege of Jerusalem by the Romans, when the Romans besieged Yerushalayim, so the Jews inside Yerushalayim, it was such an impregnable fortress, Yerushalayim, they had enough grain to last for 21 years. You know that? They had enough grain stores. And there was an underground spring that came up in the old city that watered the old city. There was enough water and there was enough food supplies for a siege of 21 years the Romans couldn't break through. So the sages said that the way they handled this problem, and the whole thing arose to a misunderstanding. There were two Jews had an argument, and one of them went and told the Romans that the other Jews were against them. You have to study that Gemara. And because of that, the Romans marched against Jerusalem. They thought there was a rebellion. So Rabbi Yochanan and the sages said to the Jewish people, the way to handle this is by quiet diplomacy. They're not making a stand and standing up on the ramparts and just let them settle down. They can't take us. 21 years of supplies we have here. We'll send out a few of the sages to negotiate wisely with the Romans and explain it was a mistake and give a few gifts and bribes. And who cares what? And we'll deal with them. What did the Baryonim do? They burnt the grain supplies of the city. The young militant Jews who said, never, we'll fight to the death. You follow? Not people imbued with a Torah mentality. They couldn't care less about what happened to Jewish life. What was important was the stance and what it would look like and the rebellion. And of course they did it in the name of Jewish greatness. What do you think made them do it? They were doing heroic acts. You understand this? They weren't doing a cowardly act. The heroic act of suicide to show who we Jews are. Just think for a second. What's more important? To show who we Jews are and die showing it? Or negotiate sensibly and carry on and survive? You follow? That's what they did. They burnt the supplies and there was no way. There was no way out. So finally Rabbi Yochanan took matters into his own hands and he escaped from the city, pretended he died. They wouldn't have let the Baryonim wouldn't let anyone out. They wouldn't let the sages out to negotiate. They didn't want to negotiate. They want to fight the whole Roman Empire and die doing so. Rabbi Yochanan pretended he was sick and eventually pretended he died and they put him in a coffin. The only reason you were allowed out was to be buried. Not allowed to be buried in the old city. And then the Baryonim wanted to stick spears and swords through the coffin to make sure he was dead. And only because his disciples said that you can't desecrate the body of a holy man like that, they didn't do it. And finally got out and negotiated. The Romans, it was too late already. Managed to extract from the Romans three promises that they wouldn't destroy certain things, but it was too late. Can you hear a familiar ring to this battle? And you know what the battle would sound like? Just put it in your own mind into modern terms. We won't be told what to do. That's been our history for thousands of years. We'll show them what we made of. We'll stand up and fight. And then there's this quiet voice, counseling, wise negotiation. And then the young, brash voice, could you hear it answering? You mean you want us to be obsequious and bow and scrape and send gifts and call somebody sir? Can you hear it? Yes, exactly. That is exactly what you're supposed to be doing. Do that correctly and live a Torah life the way you're supposed to, and you won't have to do that again. Well, I hope the message is clear. There was a time during the demonstrations in New York. Let me take another example for you. That's not politically active anymore. There was a time 10 years ago. There were demonstrations in New York outside the Russian embassy to let Soviet Jews go. Do you know what the rabbinic advice at the time was? I don't know if you're aware. The Orthodox rabbinate that was involved, certain members, I happen to be personally know some people who were involved in this personally, were personally involved in negotiations that were allowing Russian Jews out. And the Russian authorities told them that the more high profile the protests would be, the less they'd be allowed able to let out, even though they wanted to let them out. But they couldn't be seen to be backing down to the pressure of protests. You hear this? So the Jews in the street outside, they're completely safe in America. Not people suffering under the Soviet, imprisoned in psychiatric hospitals and so forth in Russia. Those in the safety of America decided, we can't let our brothers suffer. In Russia, we'll protest. So those who knew explained to them, but the more you protest, the less they're going to be allowed out. We have it on good authority from inside sources that the more high profile you make your protest and the more you force and lobby authorities in America to pressurize the Russian government so the less they can be seen to back down. The Fed government doesn't do that. Publicly say, when they protest, we better back down. So the more protest, the more they close the doors. You hear that? Does that make any sense? So they're costing Jewish lives. Could you imagine going up to a young protester in the street who's maybe been without lunch and has been all day standing there with a sign outside the Russian embassy that no one, I promise you, has bothered to look at. And I look at the Russian embassy pitifully looking at the signs. And you tell him that he's costing Jewish lives in Russia? probably cost your life. Give you a more painful example. 50 years ago, when the first news came out of Germany about what was happening. And if you're familiar with this, you should read books that document this period. You can read secular books that document the period. You can read Perfidy. You can read religious books that document it. You'll see it clearly. When the news started coming out of Europe, what was happening to the Jews and what was potentially about to happen to them, before the final solution had been proposed, it was just getting underway in the early years of the war. So a group of rabbis, so-called rabbis, from denominations other than what we unfortunately call Orthodox, other than, I'm not going to mention names, a large group of those representing the non-Orthodox Jewish community in America, they made protests, right? They made protests against, first of all, they stopped food packages being sent in. What was happening was a lot of Jews were being saved, and a lot of food packages and medicines and things were being smuggled in. These people were behind that being stopped. You know why? Because they said we're American, and that's helping the enemy. Those food packages are being intercepted, and they're being used by the enemy. And the few that get through to Jews, well, we'll sacrifice those, you follow, because we dare not help the enemy. We're Americans. But then what happened? When the protests reached a climax, when they were standing on the steps of the Capitol, you can actually see photographs of it, they declared war on Germany. You hear that? In the name of the Jewish community of America. You hear that? In the name, listen carefully. This is what these non-Orthodox, non-Torah, anti-Torah individuals decided to do. We're not walk between the raindrops Jews. We've had enough of that in Jewish history. We stand up and be seen. We're high profile. We stand up. This is before the foundation of the State of Israel. In the freedom and wealth of America, you follow, they decided that the way to handle themselves is the Tanakh Jew. We handle ourselves in royal fashion. So they declared war on Germany. You hear this? Publicly. In the name of all Jews in America. Claiming that they represented the Jewish community of America, they personally declared war on Germany. Do you know what observers say, who were with the leader of Germany at the time? May his name be blotted out. That when the news was reported to him, he was with the leaders of his inner circle at the time. And it's been well reported, you can read it in chronicles of that period, non-Jewish sources entirely. When the news was given to him, in public, in front of his highest officers, that the Jews of America had declared war on him, he fell down. He lay down on the carpet. He had a tantrum. He beat his hands and feet on the carpet and he bit the carpet in a rage. And he got up and proposed the final solution. I said, we're going to wipe them out now. You hear what's going on? That means these people who are safe in America, who feel that we conduct ourselves in a high-handed fashion, that's how the Jew is. After all, look in Tanakh, and there are plenty of sources for it. Every chapter of Tanakh, you think King David walked between the raindrops. Does it say he bowed and scratched anybody? Does it say that Solomon asked apologetically or sent any gifts any place? That's Jewish history, so they showed it on every page of Tanakh. So they were based in Torah. They said, we're the Torah people. We know how to conduct it. That's how we work. So they were the cause of the final solution. Part of it. The Orthodox rabbinate in America was advocating quiet negotiation. They had already succeeded in buying the lives of thousands of Jews. And of course they wanted to stop that too. Because who were they paying? They were paying German authorities. They were paying $1,000 for a truckload of Jews. They were paying a truck at a time for 1,000 Jews. And thousands of Jews were got out and bought that way. But these people objected because you're paying money to the enemy. These are sad facts of our history. These are sad facts of what happens to Jews who move away from Torah. What happens when they move away from Torah? They move away from common sense too. They move into a non-Jewish ideal of external show, trappings of externality, what looks good in public consumption, what I look good doing. And mostly you'll find that sincere Jews don't only do it from the security. Let's not bring them down that low. They don't only do it from the security and freedom of free countries. They're prepared to do it when they're going to die as well. The Baryonim burnt the supplies in Yerushalayim. They were butchered also. Jewish sincerity and Jewish idealism, when it goes wrong strong. And they do it with sincere, with a lifeblood. Let's give them that. But it's wrong and it's unnecessary. Where does it leave us? Where it leaves us is without any practical, I'm not going to make any practical statements or conclusions. I'm not capable of it. But a Jew has to know that before you start thinking of high profile stances about how the Jewish community is perceived, and what is your high profile sort of image that you're projecting, you have to know, what does Da'as Torah say about it? Does Da'as Torah say lie low and be forgotten? Does Da'as Torah say now it's time to stand on the ramparts and be seen? Does Da'as Torah say choose an in-between line since you're a guest in a strange place? Some combination of those? You have to know. You need a leader who's a Torah-imbued individual with no vested interest, the kind of person who doesn't want to be your leader, who knows what Torah means, and you have to have guidance from him. And you have to go to such a person on the eve of any political move or unrest or whatever it is, and you have to know what exactly is it that you're supposed to be in this situation. But maybe we should be speaking up for what's wrong when we see injustice done. Yes, that could well be. Could well be. But maybe there's a certain way to do it. Maybe you should speak up for what's right, making sure that certain other things where you're benefiting from certain things that are wrong are kept in low profile. You're not going to be appreciated for standing up. Can't help myself saying a few. You're not going to be appreciated for standing up on the ramparts and saying exactly what justice should be done while you levitate about town from one place to another in something that's gold plated, you follow, with purple. You follow me? Or you live in some sort of edifice, all of whose fancy trappings are on the outside, specifically to be seen that way. I'm not going to endear you to anybody. No one's going to admire your sense of morality and moral outrage. On the contrary, it's going to go worse for us because of that. Definitely. The history of Jewish protest in the liberal Western societies has been that they were the victims of both sides. I hope you're aware of that. They were the victims of both sides. And when social change happened, the first targets were the Jews, including those who had marched originally in the protest marches. That still doesn't mean it's wrong to protest. Sometimes you have to also. Definitely, you have to live in accordance with it. And you have to protest where appropriate. And you have to live that way too. Understand that if you're worried about a profile, about an image, about being seen to protest, then you should be worried about being seen correctly in the first place. If you want to be seen to stand up for what's right, then before you do that, you have to be seen to be Jewish the way a Jew should be. If you seem to be somebody who's taking away the wealth that somebody else thinks he should be having, so then you better disappear. Never mind standing up for anything else and being high profile. You better be hiding under there. We're not talking idealism, it's pure common sense. But if you seem to be somebody whose values are spiritual, if that's how you seem, if you seem to be a person who sacrifices everything for the spiritual reality, then what means more than life itself to you is living by your spiritual system. Why should anyone have anything against you? Why on earth should anybody have anything against you? What threat do you pose to them? On the contrary, you see a person of tremendous spiritual value. Do you think any non-Jew is threatened by a Jew who sits learning some dusty old volumes all day? Think that's any problem? Why shouldn't they have respect for that? Not so simple. There's many other themes that have to be discussed also, but that's at least one. And therefore, just to summarize, we have to know that the way we conduct ourselves privately in our profile that's visible in terms of your individual neighbor and the person you work with and your friend that you work with, long before you consider the pronouncements that you have to make about social injustice and so forth, although you have to consider those too, is the statement you make just by the clothes that you wear and the kind of values that you speak about and the sort of person that you are and the role that you fulfill in your personal ambit in society. The kind of home that you live in and what's projected on the outside and what's projected on the inside of it and all the trappings of externality that you project. Those are far more important in terms of a statement than what you get up and say publicly. And if you do those wrong, you may be paralyzed from stating publicly, because it would be even less believable than if you hadn't said it. And if you still do have to speak publicly, or the leaders of the Jewish community have to speak, it has to be according to Torah. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes gifts and bowing and scraping and saying, sir. Jewish lives are more important than the indignity of having to do that. And sometimes not. Sometimes you have to be a Mordechai and stand up to Haman, tell him that you're not going to bow down. It's my personal feeling, can't quote you any sources, it's my personal feeling that modern Israeli society is built on this mistake. That there's an ethic, that there's a country that's been built, that's based itself on the Tanakh ideal, the Tanakh ethic, the royal Jewish militant controlling ethic in an inappropriate time zone in history. You'll find, for example, anybody's familiar with Israeli society, you'll find that secular Israelis, completely anti-religious, Zionistically oriented political Israelis are very much in favor and very knowledgeable often about Tanakh. Do you know that? There's many an Israeli tour guide or Israeli army officer who's violently anti-religious who can virtually quote the whole Tanakh from beginning to end. You can start any pasuk in Tanakh and you'll finish it. More than almost any yeshiva book. Are you aware of that? But asking anything about the Gemara, about the Mishnah, about the Talmud, he has a queasy, uneasy feeling in his stomach when you talk about Mishnah and Gemara. Because he sees it as the product of an obsequious, bent-over Jew, the product of a medieval, an Eastern European, battered, cowardly Jew. And he does not go with that. He doesn't relate to that. Talmud, something that he's never been shown, doesn't relate to, doesn't see it as wisdom, sees it as a vacillating, cowardly, that's how he sees it. The image that's been built, is that we'll take matters into our own hands. We'll behave, we'll be military, militaristic, militant, we'll control, no matter what's ranged against us, if necessary we'll burn the stores, we'll show them. We'll show them, you know why? Because for thousands of years we haven't been shown. Because for thousands of years we've been marching like sheep to the slaughter. This time we're not going to do it that way. We're going to fight. And we'll idolize and adulate anybody who didn't march like sheep to the slaughter. It's not so simple. And that's why Tanakh is very high on the list. And that's the basis for this ideology. And that's where the militancy comes from. And those two are connected. And that's not necessarily the right way. The right way is a correct combination, a correct Torah balance of what's needed. Military might? Absolutely. It says that Jacob prepared for battle. First he sent gifts, plenty of gifts, deeply impersonal things that he needed, that will have to be returned one day. Gave them away? Absolutely. And then he bowed down 7 times. And he spoke in a certain way. It says when Esav came towards him, he said, you know what he said? When Esav said, where do you get all this from? All these gifts that you sent, who, where, what? Yaakov said, read the words. Go back to your chumash and read the words. I'm a humble man. He says, I've got an ox and an ass and a maid servant and a maid. All in the singular, you know, like one donkey, and as if to say, what have I got? What can you benefit? So you take, you want to overtake me, you want to slay me and take everything. What are you gain? What's in it for you? You're a man who thinks of profit. You're a man who thinks of physical expansion and profit. What's in it for you? Say you'll wipe me out. What will you have? A few miserable sheep, a camel here and a donkey there, a few children that you don't value anyway. Extra maid servant. That's how he spoke to Esau. Self-deprecating. But then he prepared for war. Prepared for war, and if necessary, he fought to the death. He split the camp, split his family, 2 different camps, so that militarily, if there'd be a threat to the one, the other one would be saved. He behaved like a strategic general. And if necessary, he prepared to fight to the death. He wouldn't have just sat back and been wiped out. He would have fought to the death, and if you had to do that, fight like a tiger. If necessary, you might have to be a Maccabee. The Maccabim weren't professional soldiers. The Maccabim were Shiva Bukhrim. And when the last stage arrived, there was nothing else for it. They took out hidden swords that they had in the olive oil pitchers. And they went out to fight against elephants. It was a hopeless battle. But that was the din that the Torah required at the time. And they won the battle. So before a person makes pronouncements or writes to the newspaper or appears, phones up these circuses, that your voice should be heard, you know, with a Jewish surname, pronouncing. You know. Before that, you speak to your local Orthodox rabbi. You get the guidance of what Torah demands in this particular situation. And you find out what degree of your personality should be the kind that behaves like King David, and what personality and what percentage and what proportion of your behavior should be walking between the raindrops.